This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, news from the word mines. What no one tells newbies about writing and publishing.
So I think this episode is quite important for a number of reasons.
Yeah, definitely. It's sort of been playing on my mind in the sense of obviously we've done episodes on our own writing processes and, you know, the biggest lies in publishing kind of thing. But this is a case of, I guess, I don't want to say manage your expectations going in, but know what to expect. And I keep seeing things on Twitter. Sometimes they're basically, as far as I'm concerned, they're horror stories about someone who's been horribly taken advantage of. And sometimes it's a case of someone says something that is genuinely really, really stupid, and they're saying it as advice to other newbie writers. I'm just there going, no!
Yeah. I also think that I remember seeing a post by Leah Bardugo about how she, after the sort of releasing the Shadow and Bone series, she kind of felt like she was a failure still, because things weren't going exactly as she expected them to be going. She was still having to do the daily grind. She was making her own merchandise. And we'll go into this a little bit later, but ultimately, she actually felt very disappointed with herself instead of actually realizing that she had still succeeded something really remarkable in terms of releasing this series. And, you know, she was actually doing okay. She was doing very well, actually. But she felt so ashamed of herself. And I think that it's really important to kind of go in and know what the reality is going to look like, because frankly, the way that they portray sort of writing and publishing, usually on the screen or in movies and stuff like that, is entirely inaccurate.
Definitely. So we'll get into that, but basically, this is all things we wish we'd known when we got started with this writing malarkey.
Yeah.
And while this kind of applies more to people who want to write professionally or to publish professionally, there's definitely some snippets in here for those who just want to write for fun as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so who are we to talk about writing publishing advice? Just in case you are not one of our regular listeners and you just saw this title and thought, oh, that sounds like it's for me. I'm a hybrid author, which isn't as exciting as it sounds. It means also I have traditional publishing contracts and also indie publishing contracts. And I say indie publishing contracts, meaning I support myself. I publish my own stuff as well. I've had a relatively successful urban fantasy series out for several years now, and also a historical fiction bestseller. I have a little bit of experience. I've been doing this for about 6 years now, maybe longer. No, I think it's more like 7 years. So yeah, best part of a decade. It's amazing how time flies when you write a lot.
it's true. It's very, very true. So like Jules, I'm a hybrid. So started off with traditional, gone into indie. I'm also a creative writing lecturer at the University of Winchester. And I have lots of things, many of which have not seen the light of day yet, but which are planned for forthcoming. My fantasy series has been a bestseller on Amazon. And I also have an urban fantasy series, which is set in the same universe as Jules's, which will be released in upcoming years, so you can keep an eye on that.
Okay. So.
And yes, we've had experience of, you know, several sides of the publishing world, both from the personal, from the traditional, from the indie, the good, the bad, the ugly, the wonderful. And also, we are both, because of our time on Dissecting Dragons, but also because of the way we've been connected with other authors. We've been around, we've heard a lot of stories, we've spoken to a lot of people. And so today we wanted to talk about, you know, some of the things that we've experienced and that other people have talked about, which we think would be beneficial to newbie writers, particularly because these were things that we wish we had been told before we started.
Yeah, definitely. Right, so what we've done is we've each compiled a list of our top sort of things we wish we'd known, and we're just going to sort of take it in turns and discuss it from there.
Yes. So I guess I'll go first. And my first bit of advice comes in sort of two parts. To begin with, don't quit your day job.
Yeah, can't actually stress that one enough. Chuck Wendig, who is a successful full-time writer now, has said you should keep your day job right up until the point it actually starts to become inconvenient and impinges on your writing. There's an awful thing that keeps rearing its head on Twitter and on Facebook where someone says if you want to really be a writer, you've got to put yourself under pressure. So quit your day job and just focus on your writing. And that's great, but you know what's really not conducive to being able to write? Paying a mortgage with no money, or trying to eat, yeah, or pay rent with no money.
Exactly. But frankly, the fact of the matter is that whenever you kind of see all these sort of, you know, these writers of the past and this whole romanticised part of writing, you have to remember that a lot of those writers actually didn't need to work. They were already quite wealthy,
yeah,
people. And then, of course, you do have the, you know, you have the poverty-stricken writer who's writing and because they have to, and, you know, that's all romanticised. There's no need for that. There is absolutely no need to kind of just quit everything in order to write. And you are not any less worthy or any less of a writer if you choose to continue doing your day job and then just writing a little bit in the evenings or on weekends or even just working part-time instead. But essentially, even when you become a writer as well, I say when you become a writer, if even when you start to publish work, the fact of the matter is that these huge paychecks, they are not that common. And also, you might get one huge paycheck for the first series, because there does tend to be a bit of an emphasis on debut authors, you know, who make it big. That doesn't mean that every paycheck you're going to get is going to be triple figures. Not at all. In fact, recently, particularly in the UK, there's been a whole thing with the Society of Authors basically pointing out the fact that writing, you can no longer live off of writing. You just can't. Most writers in the UK do have to have another job at the same time. So you've got to really consider the fact that if you're thinking, I'm going to write because it's going to be my big break and I'm never going to have to work again, that's definitely not how it works. Of course, you might make it big. You might make it really, really big. You could, you know, become a millionaire with writing. That is always possible. But the reality is that it's a daily grind. And if you are starting out, you are probably going to want to keep hold of your day job, at least in the beginning, until, as Jules says, it starts to get in the way of the writing. And that's when your writing becomes your day job and can actually provide a steady and reliable
income. Yeah, I'd add a couple of things to that. Madeline's absolutely right. Most writers cannot afford to keep themselves just on their writing if they're being published traditionally alone. If, yeah, however, you are a hybrid writer or you are an indie writer who is prolific and has a good platform and a lot of marketing nouns, then it's perfectly possible to make a living income from writing. So this isn't to like discourage, yeah, anyone, but you are unlikely, unless you're, say, Nora Roberts or Shauna Maguire, someone, or, you know, Dick Francis, and you produce 4 books a year, every year, mm-hmm, religiously, continually, and you will be doing it for the rest of your life, then yeah, you might be able to live being a mid-lister without even being a big name kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
with just traditional publishing. But it's unlikely, because one thing I will say is the minute you're contracted to write books you haven't actually written yet, it's amazing how quickly the muse just sort of flies out the door and abandons you.
It's true. I think the other thing of that is that actually if you are sort of a mid-lister and you are sort of publishing both traditionally and independently, it's also basically about, it's a mixture of quality and quantity. That's not to say that your quality drops at all. That's, to be honest, quality really doesn't have very much to do with actually how popular a book becomes or whether it gets
diplomatic.
Awards and things like that.
That was very diplomatic.
Well, no, I'm sorry. I'm serious, though, because the fact of the matter is that actually, you know, you get all these prizes for literary fiction. Literary fiction sells very badly. It always has. You can get the prizes, it's all very prestigious, but the fact of the matter is that most of the things that most people consume is genre fiction. What I'm saying is that quality really has nothing to do with it. But quantity, that, you know, you have to be able to produce work at a regular rate. So if you're like me and it's taking you years, I'm so guilty. I have my reasons. Then you're probably not going to be able to just go out and just be like, yeah, I certainly wouldn't be able to say, right, I'm just going to be writing from now on. It would not serve me at this point in time. If you're like Jules, however, who can just sit down one day and then 3 days later produce a book. That's not me being jealous, but you do write. You write quickly, efficiently, and very, very well, which means that you can produce work at a regular rate. Of course, it's not all that there is to it. But being able to write continuously is a big part of it as well. So yes, you can live off of just writing as well, but certainly to start with, I wouldn't just go, right, I'm going to become a writer now, so I'm going to quit my day job. That's not a very good idea, unless you already have a reliable form of income coming in, or you can survive without your particular job. Certainly don't start as a writer, go, right, I'm going to write my first book, and expect it to pay out immediately.
No, definitely not. And okay, maybe you have a supportive partner who's happy to pay for everything, but I would say that if that is the case and you're not contributing anything else, if they don't love their job, then that's going to put a lot of strain on the relationship. So maybe think about a part-time job. Anyway, that's not really any of my business. So moving on from there, this kind of ties in with the point Madeline's just made. And that is, you're incredibly unlikely to make it on your first book, or even on one book alone. That's really unusual. We get told this fairy tale of the overnight bestseller, and the thing that the overnight bestseller has in common, or these people have in common, is not so much what they write or how they write. They have hit the market with a book that they wrote because they loved the idea, but it may not have been particularly marketable, and it's hit the market at exactly the right time for people who actually want to read it. The thing is, most of them are on their fourth, fifth, sixth, maybe even 12th book. You just haven't heard of them before. So they're not overnight bestsellers who've come from nowhere. These are people who have spent years, possibly decades, honing their craft, and they happen to hit a gap in the market. And that's good, you know, good for them. And there is a certain amount of them being created as well, as in publishers see the potential. Certainly if we're talking big five publishing, they'll see the potential and they won't necessarily give them huge advances to start with, but they'll keep them ticking over and they'll be a comfortable mid-lister right up until the point where someone says, actually, I think that one could potentially make it. And they put a marketing push behind them. And I've got to say, the other thing you need to think the thing is, we talked briefly about the large advances. Well, yes, sometimes someone comes out with something that publishers think, oh god, yeah, we must have that because I think that could be the next best thing. Here's the thing no one tells you. publishers don't know. They haven't got a didgeridoo. They have no more of a clue than anybody else does. Not really.
Yeah.
So if they're investing in something, yeah, they might be right. And perhaps 40% of the time they are, certainly enough that they make enough money back. But more often than not, when they give an author a big advance like that, they lose money because that author never earns out the advance.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. When they give you an advance, say they give you £40,000, which is actually a big advance. Most advances are more in the line of about
£4,000.
If they give you a £40,000 advance, if you do not sell enough copies of that book within a given time frame, then you are a loss. So the next time you go to sell a book to that publisher, they will offer you less of an advance, probably, because it's a business. They're not your friends. They might be very nice people and they might like you personally, but what it comes down to is they're making money and they want to make money out of your book. And if your books will not make them money, then they are not going to keep giving you big advances just because they like you.
Yeah.
So if all that sounds a bit harsh, yes, I suppose it is a bit, but think about the fact that once you've produced the book, it's no longer just a book, it's no longer just your dreams, the things that you came up with, your creation, your baby. It's also become a commodity for sale.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of authors have difficulty with the business side of things in the sense of looking at their book also as a product. It will always be something wonderful that you created. And nobody can take that away from you. But once you're trying to publish it traditionally, it's also, you know, it's an item, it's a commodity.
Yeah.
Not that you should even be thinking about quitting on a £40,000 advance, by the way.
No. No. But we'll get to that in a minute. So my next little bit of advice, of something that I kind of wish I had known is, you will have to organise a lot of stuff on your own, and doing that doesn't make you a failure. The idea that your publisher, I mean, depending who your publisher is, they may have a marketing, you know, quota for you. They may have some money put aside for marketing for you. But the fact of the matter is that even very, very, you know, successful authors, again, Leah Bardugo, still have to organise their own, you know, their own sort of book visits, their own book signings. They might have to make their own merchandise to give away for free. You will have to organise stuff on your own. Now, this means that actually you've got to be prepared to do that. You've got to actually look into how you can do that successfully. And you've also got to realise that that doesn't mean you're faking it. I think something that a lot of people, you know, particularly starting authors, feel is, oh, this isn't real, actually. I'm kind of faking it. Everyone thinks, you know, I'm this big successful writer, but it's not real. None of it is real. And we'll talk about imposter syndrome a little bit later. But you have to be prepared to organise these things and to recognise that organising them yourself and being proactive doesn't mean that you faked it. But also that if you don't get on and do your own stuff and sort of, you know, hit the street and actually go to bookshops and organise book signings, or depending, you know, what it is, you might go to libraries, you might go to schools, you know, it's completely up to you depending what you're writing. If you don't get out and do that, your book is going to suffer because of it.
But yeah, absolutely. Basically, people can't buy your book if they don't know about
yeah.
it. And they don't want to buy your book. I can't remember the name of the author now, but he's actually a pretty good indie hybrid author. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a free book, which you can download as a PDF from his website. I'm going to have to look up his name at some point. Basically, it's called No One Wants to Read Your Shit. which, you know, tells you exactly how he tackles the content. And it's true, initially. To start with, you're not anybody. Nobody wants to read what you've written. And that's okay, because you're not going to stay nobody forever. This is a learning period. This is about making a network of friends with other writers, being guided by your peers, and also helping them in return. This is not a case of, as I've seen a few writers in various writing groups, flounce in, present their manuscript, expect adulation from everybody, and then get really, really disheartened and annoyed, and then sometimes actually quite nasty when people come back with things they could do to make it better.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not what a writing group is for. We're not there to massage your ego. So when I say making connections and network with other writers, yeah, do that by being a person.
Yeah, but we'll go more into that a little bit later. But ultimately, just a small little tip. People are more likely to buy your book if you are there.
Yeah, if you're there, and if people know it exists. And I suppose the thing I personally had the most difficulty with, and still do struggle with, is I felt I needed permission to talk about my book being published. And a lot of authors seem to feel that they need permission to start talking about it. Whereas in reality, it's absolutely fine to be, if you're being a full-rounded person on, say, Twitter or your chosen social media outlet, and then every so often pop up a little post with, book XYZ is coming out soon. This features, one gay werefox shifter type character, one werewolf who stress bakes kind of thing. I'm stealing somebody else's promotion here, but it's a really good book, so I'll pop the name in soon. And just talk about what it contains. And there's lots of different ways you can do it. And in fact, marketing, again, we'll go into it later, but it can actually be quite fun. So, you don't need permission. You don't need permission to talk about your book. If it's all you talk about, then people are going to ignore you because you become the boring person at the party no one wants to hang out with.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can't stand there in the corner waiting for somebody else to bring it up, because it's not going to happen.
No. But I mean, Jules and I, we organised our book launch together.
We did.
And we've been to, like, we went to a Comic-Con, a convention as well, where we did some advertising and we did a little thing. Doing things live actually does make a difference. Mostly also because people get to talk to you and then they become invested in you, as long as you are being a person, you know, at that time. Now, it might very well be that for you, you know, you personally might struggle with interactions and people or going and speaking out loud. So you might need to think of alternative ways that you can sort of organize and promote your work. But it is on you to do that. And more publishers, even bigger publishers, are putting a lot of emphasis on the writer's duty to market their own book. So be prepared to do that and recognise that that doesn't make you any less of a successful writer.
No, definitely not. And to be honest, even if you're a big, you know, one of the superstar writers, they still have to do a certain amount of stuff themselves. They might be able to hire, maybe they can afford to hire a publicist to do a lot of it for them. Yeah. And that's great. Or maybe they get assigned one. But that's very, very rare. So work on the theory that you're doing a lot of this by yourself. Okay, so my next point was about bestseller lists. And I think this is important simply because if you decide to go the traditional publishing route, it then becomes another milestone or another hurdle. It's really nice to be a bestseller. However, I would like to point out that things like the New York Times bestselling list, the Times bestselling list, the book list, the Richard and Judy book clubs, the Waterstones displays, the Barnes and Noble displays, all those things are not as straightforward as you think, and they're not necessarily indicative of reader preferences. So, looking at the bestseller list recently, Mark Dawson, indie author extraordinaire, someone who's done an awful lot for helping other indie authors get going. He's sold millions of books, of, you know, not necessarily of one title, but across the board of his own personal catalogue, he sold millions. He made it onto the bestseller list recently. I won't say that he sort of disdained to make it onto the New York Times bestseller list or anything, because, you know, who wouldn't want to do that? He did it by buying 4,000 copies of his own book. But the way he did it was that he wanted to support a few local indie book clubs, which due to lockdown had been in dire straits money-wise. So he said to his huge mailing list, look, if you're planning on buying a hard copy of my book, would you mind buying it through these bookstores? Or rather, would you mind buying it through me? I'm going to order my books in through these bookstores. Would you mind helping me to support them by buying the book directly from me in recompense for me buying for these bookstores, if that makes sense? And he was accused of lots of things such as gaming the system. Technically, I suppose he did, but he didn't do it in a way that I think was actually very cynical. And he was doing it with at least one altruistic motive. I'm sure he would quite like to have been on the bestseller list. But this is how these bestseller lists work. They work based on how many copies of a book you sell within a small amount of time. It's usually the week of publication. And that's how you get on a bestseller list. And let's be honest, a lot of the big five publishers actually do this for their own authors. This is not unusual. This is something that people do. So it's not a metric that proves you're a better writer. This is a case of, no, they think you should be a bestseller. They've put a big marketing push behind you. And of course, the minute something becomes a bestseller, more people go, oh, why is it a bestseller? I better buy a copy and read it and find out. Yeah. So it's actually quite a good marketing push if you think it'll go the distance, but it's something that gets gamed. Talk about the Richard and Judy Book Club. They do actually read the books.
Yeah.
But you pay, or rather your publicist, your publisher, pays quite a bit of money to get your book put on that list in the first place.
Yes. And that is, that's definitely something to think about.
Definitely. And then add on to that things like, I've heard that Waterstones doesn't do this anymore since there is a takeover, but I'm not convinced. The display tables, which, you know, where you show books front facing or in piles or on the shelves where you have the cover front facing so someone browsing is more likely to see it, all of those things, they're not put that way because the Waterstones staff like those books. They're put that way because those are paid for advertising slots.
Oh, wow.
So the thing is, it's all part of the thing we're sold, whereby the overnight bestseller is the only true metric of success. And I would like to point out very respectfully that it's bollocks.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. But again, that's not to put down anyone who wants to achieve that goal.
Absolutely not. I mean, you should have your goals and you should define what success means, but I would also say that failure just means you have more to learn, or that you have an opportunity to learn from something that didn't go as you wanted it to. It's not something to lash your back over.
No, absolutely not. Okay, so the next one that I have, which is, sorry Jules, actually different from the one I gave you, but I actually think this one is more important, is read your contracts carefully.
Yes, read them carefully. Then make sure you've joined something that's like the Society of Authors and have their legal department read it.
Yes, absolutely. It's very, very, very important, no matter the contract, no matter how trustworthy the person that you are working with, that you get a second opinion from someone different, from someone with a legal background, on any contract before you sign it. Now, this is not necessarily because the person who wants you to sign it has any nefarious purposes. You know, it's not necessarily that they're trying to cheat you. But particularly when you start out, it's very easy to fall into a contract which actually isn't beneficial to you. Now, that's not to say that you should be able to demand the best of the best of the best contract. You've got to also be a bit realistic. But at the same time, you should also actually completely understand what you are signing and make sure that you are actually absolutely happy with it. It's very important as well that you get that from somebody else, because the fact of the matter is that, you know, you need to be able to trust exactly what's on there. You need to have someone who will be able to explain it all properly, and someone who might be able to notice little red flags that otherwise, you know, might have been missed. It's just good practice. Joining the Society of Authors is a great way of doing it. You could also hire someone independently. Being open and talking about your contract with other writers as well can also be helpful. I wouldn't say that that's the only thing you should be doing. Don't just say, oh, well, I'll get another writer to have a look at it, because ultimately that's not necessarily going to help. But talking about contracts and things like that and about with other people is very important. For instance, if you know, if you're trying to get an agent, something you might want to do is talk to other people who that agent represents and ask them about the experience. Make sure that you know what you're signing up for, whether you're happy with it, whether other people have been happy with the experience of working with someone. Because this is another thing about contracts. You know, if you're entering a contract with an agent, for instance, you're going to be working with that agent. And working with that agent doesn't just mean they're going to sit back and try and find a home for your book. You know, they're going to be a big part of the whole journey for you, not just for this book, but for future books and things like that as well. So you're going to want to make sure that you are happy where you are before you jump in. It's very easy to go, yay, success, and then just jump in straight away and think, oh no, if I don't accept right now, right this minute, they're just going to revoke it. Take your time and really, really explore where, you know, what you're signing. And any agent or publisher, you know, worth their salt is going to understand and be happy for you to, you know, really, really consider things. That's not to say take years. I think anyone would get a bit pissed off, but it's okay to take a few weeks to say, nope, I'm just going to go and check this out with somebody else. You don't need to sign it the moment it's put in front of you.
Basically, one really big red flag is if you try and negotiate some terms in your contract, you're not really happy with them. Mm-hmm. That's assuming you don't have an agent doing this for you. Then the publisher goes, well, you can take it or leave it. Then leave it. Absolutely leave it, because that publisher is not to be trusted.
Yeah.
Or rather, they're not to be trusted with your work. You are just an acquisition. And don't, you know, basically, if someone's offered for your book, then somebody else will also probably offer for it as well.
Yeah.
So you do not want to be tied into something that is useless. There are things like, I mean, Madeline's actually been quite generous there in the sense of saying that they're not actually acting with ill intent. Some of them absolutely are, not necessarily with ill intent, but with the idea of they're making money, they're a business, so they're not out to make best friends with you. This is not what this is about. And they will try and make the most money they can. This is why you should be very careful about selling subsidiary rights, so things like film rights and graphic novel rights and audio rights and things. Don't sell anything that they are not clearly able to exploit.
Yeah.
Or if they absolutely insist on that and you still want to go ahead with it, make sure there's a time limit put on it.
Yeah.
Make sure there is a reasonable reason for dissolution of the contract, and make sure it's really clear.
Yeah.
I haven't got time to go into all the points now, and I did have cause to get really quite well educated on authorial contracts, so maybe I'll blog about it or something instead. But just basically, there are things to consider, and you should absolutely not just go, ah, they've been offered a publishing contract, and just sign it.
Yeah,
Madeline's right on that one.
Yeah, and it's the same with an agent, you know, working with an agent as well. Any kind of contract, you know, a short story contract, anything at all, just take your time and make sure that you really understand the contract and joining the Society of Authors or having sort of some sort of legal advice is just a really, really excellent way of going about it. I really do recommend the Society of Authors as well. They've been actually really helpful and they're a nice bunch. So,
yeah, and there are American and Australian equivalents. So there are equivalents in other countries as well.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say is, just because it's part of the contract conversation, beware of book packaging companies. Mm-hmm. These are companies that will ask you to write, they may ask you to write books in a specific genre, or they may say, yes, your book's perfect for this, and they will package it and sell it to a publisher. And what they tend to do is they grab all your rights in perpetuity.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but some of them. I find them highly suspect. This is what happened to the author of The Vampire Diaries, by the way. If you've continued to read the books after book 7, I think it was, you'll notice that they probably don't read the same. It's because they're not written by her anymore. They're written by a ghostwriter. And they decided that she couldn't write her own books anymore and that her name was what was selling them at that point. So they kept her name, they kept the books and the characters and everything else, and they had someone else come in and write them. And she could do absolutely nothing about it because she had sold all her rights in perpetuity and it was a legal transaction to this book packaging company. So again, with the whole read your contract and then get someone who is legally minded in contract law, this specific type of contract law, to also read it.
Yeah. Seriously, guys.
Cannot stress that one enough. Okay, my next one is a little bit more nebulous, really. It's celebrate the small successes and milestones. So one of the pieces of advice that was actually given to me early on was enjoy the small successes because there's a lot of heartache involved in publishing. And I was at the time I was a bit sort of like, really? I seem to be doing okay. Heartache sort of stressing it a bit more in the sentimental vein for me. But I do see this person's point, and she was right. Just because you're up today doesn't mean you won't be down tomorrow, kind of thing.
Yeah.
In terms of where you're on your publishing journey, there is an extremely good author who I know fairly well. And she had a really, really successful first book. And then the publishers didn't like her second book and she just got dropped. Dropped by the publisher, dropped by the agent. She's since gone on and, you know, started her own publishing business and done very, very well. And it's, you've never really made it, so enjoy where you are in the moment. I think it can be an author thing where you are so focused on hitting a goal that you then immediately start looking at the next goal. And I am guilty of this. Instead of thinking, hey, my book launched today. Maybe only 5 people in the world noticed that my book launched. But I did it. I got to the end. I wrote those words. I got it all completely wrapped up. I either sold it or I sent it out myself. I've marketed it to the best of my ability and I've done it. Tonight I'm having cake, kind of thing.
Yeah. You all deserve cake some days.
I think there is a thing, and it's perfectly understandable. Let's imagine you spent a year writing a book at a conservative estimate.
Yeah.
And you have spent all that time with these characters and you've edited it and you've gone through again and again and again. Maybe if you have an agent, you've then made changes at their suggestion. And then you've made changes at the publishing house's suggestion. And then your book launches and you expect a fanfare and there's absolute silence. There's tumbleweeds.
Yeah.
And that's actually not unusual. That's really not unusual because for you, it's this big life-changing event. Nothing will be quite the same because you've got a book out there. But for everyone else, the world's just continuing. It's fine, you know?
Yeah. Create your own fanfare.
Exactly. So yeah, have your own little celebration. Not everybody gets fabulous launch parties.
No. But as I said, I mentioned it before, Jules and I did a launch party together.
And we had a lot of fun.
We had a great amount of fun. It was just, you know, it was a small but sort of active crowd. It was a lot of fun. There was some nice food. And it was just really chill. And I think we all really enjoyed it. So
Yeah. We had a bit of a laugh. And I mean, yeah, it was a lot of fun. And it was great, I think, because it kind of marked the occasion for both of us.
Yeah, it did. Plus, it was the first time we met, so.
Yep. Well, the awkward handshake.
The beginning of a beautiful relationship. Which started, yeah, with a very awkward moment. A very awkward moment.
So, yeah. Celebrate the small milestones. Even if the small milestone is, wow, I finally got to 10,000 words. I remember when I first started sort of thinking, I really want to do this properly. And I and one of my writing buddies would sort of, we'd do a daily prompt and we would each start and then write the daily prompt and then swap over and read each other's work. And I remember thinking back then when I got to 800 words that I'd written a lot. Mm-hmm. time really does change your perspective on things.
Yeah. Miss, I'm going to write a short story. Oh no, it's a novella. Oh no, it's a novel.
But certainly, you know, those first 10,000 words or the first sort of, you get to 30,000 words, it's like, oh my god, I might actually finish this book. Those things are things to celebrate as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. And do celebrate. Take the time to celebrate, even the small things. Make it a pleasurable journey, not just, you know.
Not just a slog.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it will be sometimes, but.
Yeah. Okay, so my next bit of advice, and this one's really important. You are the product, not your book.
Yeah, it's marketing 101, but it's one that sort of slips by a lot of people. Ultimately, you're not selling your book, you're selling yourself.
Yes. And this is actually, I think this is really important because I think a lot of people, you know, will write a book and then they'll, you know, they'll put their heart and their soul into this book and then the book just doesn't get picked up, let's say. And maybe you don't want to self-publish it, maybe you're not ready to. Your book is not the be-all and end-all. You are a writer. It is you who's being sold. It is your ability to keep producing things, okay? It's the eggs and the chicken, okay? Ultimately, you are the chicken. You produce the eggs. And then one day, you'll get killed and roasted and eaten, maybe. But hopefully not you, exactly in that way. But the point is...
That metaphor went somewhere I'm not sure you intended for it to go.
It definitely didn't. But anyway, the point is that you yourself are... You know, the important thing. And so you shouldn't just be concentrating everything all into one book, because actually that's not going to work either. If you're going to be a writer, you need to be producing more than one piece of work. So allow yourself to consider other things. If your first book doesn't work, that's fine. You don't need to bin it. You can just put it to the side and then look and start something new and just continue writing, okay? What you are doing is just adding to your inventory, and you need a full inventory, as it were. So remember that. The book isn't the place where all the emphasis should be, you know, placed. It's you. And when you approach an agent in particular, they're not just looking to market your book, they are looking to market you as a person. So make sure that you don't just put every last bit of yourself into one book and then kind of burn yourself out. Allow yourself the freedom of recognizing that it's not just this one book, it's you as a writer that matters.
Yeah, definitely. I think I kind of wish, with this in mind, that I had worked out, and this is going to sound so stupid, but I kind of wish I'd worked out how to use Twitter properly before I Belong to the Earth came out, because I was a bit, not clueless with social media, but my crippling shyness, my huge amounts of imposter syndrome, and the fact that I was genuinely waiting for someone to give me permission to talk about my book, and the fact that I hadn't quite cracked Twitter at that point in time, all combined to make it really quite difficult to make people aware that this book was out. So yeah, that was a tricky one for me.
This is it is a big marketing thing, which is that ultimately, not only when you're trying to get a publishing contract, you know, are you the focus? And obviously, your book is fairly important, but also when you're marketing, you must be marketing yourself. And I think one of the most irritating things that I see on Twitter is just people who continuously go onto Twitter and they just continuously just promote their book, but in a really kind of dry way. And the problem is that they might have millions and millions of followers because they follow millions and millions of people. There is no engagement on any of their posts, which means that their posts are practically invisible. There's just no engagement, and that's not the point of Twitter. You want to get some engagement, and the way to engage on Twitter is to actually be a human being on Twitter, not just a bot. So, you know, you've got to actually sell yourself as a person. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you've got to be putting all of your personal, you know, information out on Twitter about everything. Doesn't mean that every time you have a sandwich you have to let Twitter know, but it's okay to post pictures of your cats or to or to review a book that you happen to have enjoyed, or, you know, to reply to things to engage. Again, that doesn't necessarily mean you've got to get political or that you've got to really get into the grit of things, but be a human being ultimately.
Basically, when we're, I mean, I can pretty much see the people waving their hands at the back, even though I'm by myself in my own study. So what do you mean, sell ourselves? Well, what we mean is, what can you uniquely bring to this equation that nobody else can bring, that people are going to find interesting? And, you know, from here, I can also now see the blank faces. So I'm going to explain what I realised. And that is, what are you interested in? What finds its way into your books that you personally have a real drive for? Because those are the things you should be talking about, and not in terms of your book, but in terms of, that's the content you should be sharing on your social media channels, that you should be blogging about on your website. So, for example, in my case, obviously I read prolifically, so I do post book reviews and things, and I do read a lot, or I do talk about the way things are shifting within the science fiction fantasy landscape, and yeah, that's fine. Other things that I like, I'm really, really into folklore. If you've read any of my books, you know this. So I will get involved in things, tags like Folklore Thursday, where we share really obscure facts from all over the world about strange beliefs and superstitions. And it's so much fun. I also like to share bits of chronicles because I write historical fiction. I write medieval historical fiction. I will almost always reblog Dr. Eleanor Janiger's work, for example, because it's such a great resource. She writes in a very amusing way.
And she vindicated us.
And she has absolutely vindicated us as well, you know, which I really appreciate. But it's about sort of like, well, I found this interesting thing. I had an entire Twitter thread about the fact that I'd read through Henry IV's account books, his personal household accounts, and how much he used to spend on sheets of linen with which to wipe his ass after having a shit. So, you know, it's weird little factoids like that.
Thank you for that little, this is
That's
our
okay.
historical fact of the day.
So what we mean when we say sell yourself, what are you interested in? What are you passionate about? It doesn't have to be political. Obviously, be your best self. But if it's something you're interested in, chances are it's making its way into your books. And chances are other people are interested too. Or maybe they're not yet, but they will be when you start talking about it. So talk.
Yeah. And the other important thing is, talking also actually means listening, engaging with other people's posts, replying, getting to know people. Again, this doesn't need to be hours and hours and hours a day of doing this, but becoming part of a community on Twitter, engaging with other people, and not just following blindly, but actually, one rule I have is I only follow people whose posts I actually am interested in, because I'm not going to just randomly follow people if I don't actually care about what they're posting about, because then, what, they're just filling up my feed with, you know, with nothing.
With bump.
Yeah, and so just really engage with people. And remember, it's not actually about the number of followers you have on Twitter. It's about the engagement you have with posts.
Yeah, absolutely.
So remember, the number actually means very little if no one is actually reading what you're putting out there, and just randomly following lots and lots of people isn't going to be helpful either. Be a person. You don't need to put everything up on there. Also remember that, you know, every time you publish something, it is in the public domain. You know, everybody can see it. You are, you know, putting that out there. So do be your best self on it. But just be a human being, and don't just constantly be talking about your book. But get involved with different tags and things like that. It really, really does make a difference. And it's nice to connect with other writers as well, at the very least.
Plus, once you're talking about things that actually interest you, it's amazing how much fun marketing is.
Yeah, definitely.
And I would also add the caveat from my perspective that try lots of different techniques for marketing, but then do the ones you enjoy. Mm. Because if it's a chore on top of everything else, and on top of producing a book and perhaps publishing it yourself, mm-hmm. you're not going to want to do it. So do the bits of marketing that you actually like doing.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, this one is going to be I've got a feeling this might be a tough call one for people. Mm-hmm. Basically, your family and most of your friends are probably not your target audience, and they are probably not going to read your book. That I've seen so many authors, some of them who seem borderline hysterical and possibly should not have been talking about this online, really going on about, you know, why isn't my family supporting me? And the thing is, they probably are supporting you. You know, there are obviously some families who don't get the whole writing thing, and that's okay too. And there are some who are actively hostile to it, and that's obviously not okay. No. They're supporting you as in they will listen to you. They might they might help you shell out for a cover or something. They might be willing to give you a birthday present, some money towards another course or whatever else it is you like to do. That doesn't necessarily mean they want to read every word you've written as though it struck gold, because it's just not.
No.
I mean, think of that time. It probably happened while you were at school, when you were given a book you had to read. You had to read it. You had zero interest in the topic, but you had to read it. Mm. Now, imagine that that book had been given to you by someone you really, really cared about, and you had to read it. And those two things don't sit together very well. It suddenly becomes really, really difficult.
Yeah.
It's almost like, instead of someone going, oh, well, I really care about this person, I better read their book, you get, I really care about this book, I really care about this person, but this book has now achieved like elephantine type weight in my mind.
Yeah.
And I cannot get through more than a couple of paragraphs.
Yeah.
And you start a mental block of the whole thing. And it's just, your target audience is not generally your friends and family. I mean, it might be, or you might make friends through this process who absolutely are your target audience. Looking at you, Madeline, looking at you.
Yeah, it's actually crazy. Like, I'm literally just 100% your target audience. No matter what you write, I'm like, yes!
And everybody should be lucky enough to have a writing buddy who is like that, definitely. But generally speaking, the people you've known for years, probably not. And, you know, I've got a friend who, he's very important to me. He was my best childhood friend, and I met him at play school. That's how long I've known him. He deserves a long service award. Mm-hmm. And we can go through a couple of weeks without talking to each other, because we both live different lives and we're busy. But whenever we get and start talking again, it's like there's been no intervening time. And he likes to write too, but he's never quite got to the point where he's managed to get himself finished, across the finish line. So he gets nagged and things by me, but every time at some point he will apologize for not having read one of my books yet.
Aww.
And I'm like, dude, don't worry, I know for a fact that this is not your stuff, for one thing. And for another, I'm still kind of freaked out that I'm pretty sure my dad reads everything I write.
This is true.
And I'm like, I honestly started off from the perspective of, you know, like many authors, why doesn't anyone care, why won't they support me, to, oh my god, I actually want to be able to write sex scenes without worrying my father will see them. So
yeah, I've had that experience with my father as well, writing scenes. some pretty horrifying scenes. I think they were actually mostly violent scenes, and my father just sort of looking at me.
What did I raise in my house? Kind of thing. Yeah, so all joking aside, yeah, I think you have to get past the whole, well, you know, they care about me, therefore they must be 100% on my side. Well, they probably are. They just might not be your target audience. Yeah. Maybe you're not writing a book that they like.
Yeah. And that's okay.
That's okay. I would like to just say I do really appreciate my dad reading my books, and I think he does do it because he genuinely enjoys them. It's not just that.
Yes.
It's not. But I'm pretty sure I get bumped up his TBR because I'm his daughter, so there's that privilege going on.
No, that's really nice. I know my father has read my books, and he does read them. He doesn't talk about them afterwards. He just sort of reads them, and that's it, really. Trying to get any information out of him afterwards is just...
It can be really tough in the sense of, oh, I really enjoyed your book. Oh, great, what did you think of X, Y, and Z? And it's like, yeah, I really liked it. I'm like, okay, we're not on the analytical page.
Exactly. She's like, yeah, but then I enjoyed it. It's like, give me a little bit more, come on.
Work with me here. But then I discover that he's recommended them to, you know, people, to some of the blokes he sings with, for example.
Aww.
And they'll come back with feedback saying, oh, can you tell your daughter I really enjoyed her books? Which is always lovely to get second hand.
That's really nice. I scared the living daylights out of Jules and said, hey, I recommended my book to my father. I recommended your book to my father. Jules was like, what?
I think my exact word was, meep.
That is exactly what she said, yes.
I've had that with Matt as well, saying, oh yeah, can I get a copy of I Hold the Tide for my mother-in-law? And I'm like, hang on a minute, your mother-in-law reads my books. Well, like, okay, that's fine. And part of me inside is sort of shriveling up.
Anyway, my next little bit of advice, which kind of follows on from that, which is that not everyone will love your book.
Yeah.
In fact, and again, it could be that, you know, you have people who are close to you who will actually kind of dislike it. And that's all right as well, because as we said, not everyone is your target audience. But also, as your book goes out into the world, you will start to get bad reviews. This is inevitable. Now, I have thoughts about bad reviews, because I actually think that, for the most part, a lot of bad reviews are a bit unnecessary. I think that some people write bad reviews purely for the sake of sort of getting follows, and they actually over-exaggerate things. I do, however, think that it's important that people who are reading things should be able to express truthfully and honestly their opinions about books. Now, this is a difference between one of Jules's critical reviews, which, if you've ever read any of Jules's critical reviews, it's probably akin to kind of like having your skin scalded by boiling hot water and then slowly peeled off. She has a biting tongue. But
I would like to point out that you only really get that on really, really big authors.
Yes, this is true.
Which perhaps is unfair and perhaps I should scale back on, and it's usually a disappointment issue.
Yeah, but I would also like to point out that, which is that when you do, the reason it's so scolding is that you hit the mark. You are analytical, you look at the good things as well, but you really, really peel it back and you say, this is this, 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 and this, basically. It's not just, I didn't like it because of X, Y, and Z. You really, really analyse it, which is probably why it hurts, because I don't know about you, but looking over a review where someone has analysed and actually really picked out the weaknesses in your work, it really does hurt. It's also very helpful.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I got an amusing 2-star review on Revolt on Amazon, in the sense of, this is not to have a go at this person, by the way, if in the unlikely event they listen to this podcast, which I think is very unlikely. But the real complaint seemed to be that the book was too short, despite the fact that it was advertised as being a novella. So
yeah,
I'm like, well, there's not very much I can do about that. I'm sorry, mate, you picked the wrong thing and you should have read the description more closely.
Yeah. And I do, yeah, I do sometimes think that people kind of will put in really bad reviews and things like that for things which actually really is kind of on them. Like, maybe you shouldn't have picked the book up. Maybe it's not your thing. The thing I hate the most is when you get people who have certain feelings, perhaps towards, you know, the LGBT community or etc., who yeah. will just give you low reviews without ever reading your book, simply because it has LGBT characters or things like that, or has certain views, and that drives me absolutely insane. Because actually, low reviews do, you know, they do have an impact. At the same time, however, if you have a book which is listed on Goodreads and it's only good reviews, people get suspicious.
Yeah, this is true. There should be a range of reviews. I mean, mostly good reviews just means that your target audience has found it.
Yeah.
Once you start getting into the hundreds of ratings, yeah. then the chances are you're going outside of your target audience. So some people will just love it anyway.
Yeah.
And some people will hate it because they're not the target audience. Mm. And, you know, that's okay.
Yeah. So the fact of the matter is that bad reviews are inevitable. Every now and again, you're going to get bad reviews which are just unhelpful and sometimes needlessly cruel, and that's literally just because the reviewer themselves are doing it for their own means. Sometimes you'll get reviews which hurt a great deal because they are honest and objective and actually helpful, like from Jules. Those reviews, even though they hurt, are actually useful, they're helpful, and there's no point sort of looking at it and going, oh god, I wish I had done better with this book. Doesn't matter. The book is out. It's done. It's finished. But as I said before, you yourself are the, you know, the main component of this entire operation. So if you are the kind of person who wants to read your reviews, take those reviews, even if they hurt, and build something on them. It's also okay to disagree with bad reviews. I've certainly disagreed with a few bad reviews. I've also agreed with several bad reviews as well. It can be helpful. You don't have to read them, but you have to accept that they are inevitable. People will dislike your book, or people will be indifferent to it.
Yeah. And while we're talking about reviews, never, ever reply to a review. In the sense of, sorry, obviously if someone that you vaguely know has written a review, you might like to say, oh, well, thank you very much, I'm glad you enjoyed the book. What I mean is never reply to bad reviews, because that person gets to write what they think, and ultimately the review is not for you, the author, it's for anybody else looking at that book.
Yeah.
Bad reviews can actually help you sell a book, because the very things that turn someone off might be exactly what someone else is looking for.
Yes.
I would say if you have a real problem and you're, you know, especially sensitive to it, and in fairness, it can be a war of attrition. If you start getting so big that you get hundreds of bad reviews to balance out the hundreds of good reviews, then maybe you should just not read the bad ones, or maybe you shouldn't read any of them at all and just keep yourself away from it.
Yeah.
They can actually be quite useful. And sometimes it's a case of, it allows you to, I mean, there was one for me where it was a case of, okay, I absolutely appreciated this really in-depth analytical review. I was worried perhaps I'd betrayed the reader. Mm-hmm. And then I went back and thought about it and then thought, no, I didn't. I couldn't have done anything more than I did. It's unfortunate that person didn't like the direction I went in, but I stand by what I did. You know, that's a useful process. It's not something to get all wrapped up about and think that it's a judgment on you as a person. It's not.
No.
However, you replying to it and getting really pissed off and doing what I've seen some authors do, where they go from defending themselves, telling the person they're too stupid to have read that book, to outright bullying.
Yeah.
Or trying to suppress a review, that absolutely becomes a judgment on you as a person.
Yes, it really, really does.
Don't do it.
Don't get involved. Don't get involved unless you happen to know the person, at which point maybe get involved privately.
And there are some who are awful. I mean, I've seen Shauna Maguire has said, you know, she she's fine with people not liking her books. They're not going to be for everyone. She's also had people giving her one star and saying Shauna Maguire's obviously too fucking fat to write properly.
Yeah.
Which is not acceptable.
No.
And I've seen reviewers who've done the same thing, but with racist or homophobic comments. And again,
yeah,
you know, writing too gay to function on somebody's book is not a review.
No.
That's just displaying what a shitty person you are to the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, harden yourself. These things will happen. That doesn't mean that you haven't written something good. And it also doesn't mean that you can't write something even better.
Yep. Okay, my next one. I'm going to skip one because I think this one's a really important one. And that is, this is one that nobody tells you. I think you think that you write a book, you get published, perhaps you do a few more, mm-hmm. and eventually you start to feel like a writer. And maybe you do. But the imposter syndrome never goes away.
No.
The sense that you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, that you've got everything wrong, that you're exposed, that you're walking around without your skin on kind of thing.
Mm.
That maybe you've given a little bit too much of yourself in your books.
Or that at any second someone's going to turn around and say fraud.
Yeah, that, exactly. You learn to manage it, but it never goes away. So I'm sorry if that's disappointing some listeners, but yeah, there are days when I feel like a huge fraud. One of the things that is most paradoxical for this for me is I get fan mail from people who especially like my books. I do get them for Unveiled. I get a lot more fan mail for the historical stuff because they seem to want my target audience for the historical stuff seem to want a more personal connection with the author rather than just sort of leaving a review they want to tell me personally,
mm-hmm.
which is lovely. It's really, really nice to get fan mail. At the same time, every time I get something like that, I can't help this knee-jerk, gut-clenching moment of dread as well.
Yeah.
That sort of, oh God, this is another person and they can't see I'm a fraud yet, so it's going to be an even harder fall than I eventually do topple kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say that on some level that's actually healthy because it keeps you balanced. On another level, it's a real pain and it can be a real heartache. And I think one of the things that can actually really help with the imposter syndrome can be not to compare yourself with others. Not to say, well, they're, you know, that I'm not a real writer. That person over there is a real writer. Look what they're doing. You know, don't compare yourself with others. Particularly don't compare yourself with people who you don't actually know, who you only see about on Twitter or on social media and things like that. Because you don't know what's going on behind the curtain. Just like people don't know what's going on behind, you know, the curtain of your Twitter. The fact of the matter is that there is no correct timeline for your journey as a writer, and there's not really any one particular correct way of going about everything, which means there's no point comparing yourself. It will only flare up your imposter syndrome even more.
Definitely. And I think a lot of writers of sort of this next generation, particularly science fiction, fantasy and young adult writers, a lot of them have come forward and said, yeah, we bought into the overnight bestseller myth and we fell into the fake it till you make it trap. So we portrayed ourselves as being slightly more successful than we were in the hopes that we would become successful. And now that we are successful, we can kind of see it for the lie it was. And we yeah. don't want other people to feel that way.
Yeah.
And Leigh Bardugo is one person who has come forward and said that. And there's been others as well. Susan Dennard as well, mm-hmm. who writes the Truthwitch series. You know, she said she still loves her first series, but they didn't do very well.
Yeah.
It made a good springboard for the next, but she said, you know, once again I was being pushed into that position where I had to display myself as being more successful than I actually was, whereas it would be better to say I love this series, I stand by what I've written, it hasn't sold as well, I've got high hopes for this next series. And if we all started doing that, then it would actually take some of the power back for the authors.
Yeah, absolutely. Which kind of leads on to my next and my last little bit of advice, which is something I really think really wish I'd kind of known a little bit more about, which is that other writers are your friends.
Yeah.
Now, there is always that kind of, oh God, what if someone else in this room steals my idea? And that's a kind of a natural thing to do whenever a bunch of creatives get together. And that's not to say that there aren't nasty people out there who will swoop in and try and steal from one another. But actually, other writers are not in competition with you in the same way. You should connect with them. And it's very important as well, when you're going into sort of the publishing route, that you do connect with other writers. Connect with other writers who have the same agent, who are part of the same publisher, who work within the same genre. It makes such a significant difference. Not least because actually, if there's a problem, it's much, much better if you can band together. If you are concerned or worried or need advice, it's much, much better if you have a group all together. You can make lifelong friends, such as with Jules and I. I'm going to get mushy now, but I literally cannot imagine my life without Jules now.
Yeah, same.
And it started just because we happened to be with the same publisher.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we won't go into that publisher, but it was like the one really, really bright thing that came out of it. And honestly, I wouldn't trade it for anything.
No, it's been wonderful. And I think the problem is that you can really get so much out of working with other writers, workshopping with other writers, exchanging ideas, talking, being part of a community. But actually, for the most part, it aids a lot of people on other parts of the industry for writers not to be buddy-buddy with one another sometimes. It aids them in kind of keeping writers a bit isolated as well.
Not discussing their advances.
Not discussing their contracts. And also particularly because, you know, some people might not want to discuss their contracts or things like that because they'll think, oh God, if I show this to someone else, they'll realise that I'm fake, I'm fraud. Do not be afraid to talk to other writers. Now, that's not to say that if you are starting out, you should go onto Twitter and start bothering people. Don't do that. That's not a very nice thing to do. And don't just assume that everyone wants to be your friend. But connecting with, you know, becoming part of a group, a society, you know, a little writing community, and staying friends with people does make a difference. And whether you yourself are, you know, a highly successful published author and someone else in the group is just someone who happens to write a lot of fan fiction, that doesn't mean that they don't also have something to contribute to you, just as you do to them. Writers can be at any stage of their journey and still be, you know, integral and a brilliant part of your writing experience. So be friendly with them. Come up with a little group. It makes such a difference.
Definitely. I think the thing is, it's not like there's only so much pie to go around.
No.
So you could argue that, I suppose, in terms of agent time and publisher attention, yeah, there is only so much pie. But there's no reason with, as Madeline says, if groups of you sort of band together and form support networks, that actually you can't then work towards a fairer distribution of the pie. I'm overdoing the pie analogy, but
everybody gets pie.
Everybody gets pie. Everybody gets pie at some point. And, you know, it's quite a lonely thing, writing.
It is.
Potentially. And you might enjoy, you might get the euphoria of having written something. But if you don't have anybody to share that with, even to share the small achievements of, oh, I finally got to 30,000 words, or I finally finished book three. Yeah, it's kind of, it can be quite disheartening, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, flashback to the friends family conversation, I didn't touch on the fact that, your partner might not be interested in what you write, which seems like the ultimate betrayal. But actually, no, they often support you in other ways. They just might not like your books, and that's okay.
Yeah. So it's okay. it must be said, if you know, if you're surrounded by people who are not particularly interested in your book, it really does make a difference to then just sort of go online and be like, hey, and just be able to gush with somebody else.
Well, it's like Alan will say after a writing session, or how are things going? I'm like, yeah, great, I finished this book. And he's like, oh, right, so what are you writing about? And I said, I'm writing about cryptids. And he's like, what are cryptids? So having explained that, he's like, all right, yeah, that sounds vaguely interesting. And then he'll go back to doing what he's doing. And it's like, it's not that he hasn't read some of my books. He has, and he quite likes my style, but he doesn't like it enough to want to bump it up the pile.
No.
And, you know, that's okay. I don't have to be his favourite author. I'm actually fine not being.
It's also worth saying that actually sometimes within your writing groups, you will have someone who likes some of your work but won't necessarily get that excited about other parts of your work. That's okay as well. I have someone who, my partner, who's more interested in my children's fiction than the Hamartia cycle, who, they don't really like the Hamartia cycle that much.
And it's like, well, okay, obviously I have to question his taste a little bit, but you know what, that's fine. That's fine. It's not for everyone.
No. So there you go. It's okay if you don't love every single piece of writing that someone else has done, but do kind of come up with these little communities. And it doesn't need to be a big community, but become friends with other writers and make sure that you are friends with them. You're not just trying to connect with them for your own means. That can be that's not a good thing to do at all.
In addition to that, I would say, look, I'll hand on my heart here, there are writers I benignly stalk online because I'm just interested in what they do. I do not presume that we have a close friendship or association, even when they have like answered my posts once or twice.
Yeah.
I don't know them. They don't know me. I'm not going to start messaging them as though we suddenly become best friends, because that's not how it works.
No.
So relationships need to be built gradually over time. You can't just charge in and assume you know somebody.
Yeah. Not least because if you do that, you might actually destroy any chance of a proper relationship later on.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, it's a weird thing to do. I mean, not the benign stalking. I mean, I think we all sort of kind of do that with our favourite authors.
Yes, we do.
It's just, you know, this is going to sound awful, and I really want everyone to take this in the spirit it's intended, but successful stalking of your favourite authors is when they're not aware it's happening and everybody's happy.
Oh my god!
No, all joking aside, I use the term stalking very lightly. What I mean is, you're interested, you follow their blog post, you follow their tweets, you subscribe to their Patreon, and you like getting their free short stories. Well,
yeah.
You know, you like paying $3 a month for a short story, because for you, that's an absolute bargain.
Mm.
I can think of a couple of authors I do that with. Mm. Pinging them a friendship request, and because they're a, you know, generally nice person, and then having them sort of accept it, and then using that as an invitation to bombard them with everything, is not acceptable behaviour.
No, it isn't. Just basically think of it just as you would with anybody else, with any kind of friendship. Don't think of it as a, you know, a business opportunity. That's ultimately, if you approached, you know, most of the people that you know now, and, you know, your best friend thought, if I approach someone as a business opportunity, it wouldn't work then. You approach them as a human being. Yeah.
And that pretty much wraps up, I think, our main bits of stuff nobody told us when we got into all this in the first place.
Yes.
If you have specific questions about either the industry or about the writing process, please let us know. Get in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. Remember, we are available on Twitter. You can also find us on Facebook, or you can contact us individually. We'd love to hear from you, so do leave us comments, ping us your questions. Or if, you know, you have anything that you think that we've forgotten to add here as well, please let us know too. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, I've got one for you. So actually, this game has been out for a while. I've been playing Pokemon Shield. Pokemon Sword and Shield, which is the newest Pokemon game set in the Galar region, which is obviously inspired by the United Kingdom. Now, for a lot of people in terms of gameplay, I think there's been a bit of a level of disappointment because they actually feel that this game is a bit too easy. But I've actually really enjoyed playing it, particularly because the expansion pass has recently sort of been introduced, and there will be another expansion as well. And I've actually really, really enjoyed playing it, just in terms of the world, which is beautiful, running around. This is a particularly good game for anyone who is starting out with Pokemon. So if someone who might not have actually played any of the other games, I never really got a chance to play a lot of the other games, so this is my first real venture out into Pokemon, gaming-wise. And it's been really, really wonderful. It's actually just a really nice, relaxing, calming game, which you can kind of enjoy. So I really do recommend it to anyone, particularly during these stressful times. It's just a little bit of fun. It's beautiful. Some great music in it as well. And for those who are in the United Kingdom, you'll sort of see little bits and bobs which will actually feel familiar and kind of make you feel nostalgically at home without actually ever really presenting any true part of the United Kingdom, which is not nearly as nice. And on that note, we'll say thanks very much for listening, guys. We hope everyone is keeping well, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.